Football Weekly Extra from The Guardian in association with sportingbet.com.
From up here in near-Earth orbit, the world's like one big marble. Lines on a map, what do they mean? They mean some of us are going to the World Cup and some aren't. That's what. But today, Football Weekly Extra previews a make-or-break weekend for top footballing nations all over the world and Scotland. We ask what's gone wrong for Portugal. Is there any chance of France still stuffing it up? And with Brazil about to put Argentina even deeper in trouble, potentially, how worked up will Fernando Duarte be getting this weekend? There's a cursory nod to England's slovenly friendly, a look back at the transfer window, your posts, Ranieri at Roma and John Ashdown. He follows lower league football, so you don't have to. All that in Football Weekly Extra. Welcome on board, everybody. And in this instance, that is John Ashdown. Hello, John.
Hello, James.
Hi, Barry Glendenning.
Hi.
Hi, Barry. And Paul Dorr.
Hi, James.
Hi, Paul.
Yeah, hi, James.
Yeah, just that. I should mention that we're doing a live podcast soon, streaming live on Sunday the 20th. At 6 o'clock, straight after some important Premier League games. That's in a couple of weeks. So do make sure you join us for that. Anyway.
And it was all organised behind my back without my knowledge. And I won't be here for it.
Exactly. Okay, but that's for the future. This weekend, it's all about international action. As I mentioned, they're getting to the make or break stage. There's a lot of dull stuff out there in international football, but hopefully we've found one or two nuggets of... more lively stuff. Who's already there, Barry, at the World Cup?
I've made a list. Already qualified are South Africa, Australia, Japan, North Korea, South Korea, and Holland. So if you take the Dutch out of that, it's not going to take much winning.
Indeed not.
There'll also be one of New Zealand, Bahrain, or Saudi Arabia.
Upping the ante a little bit there.
Not really.
All right then. Plenty of teams in trouble, chief amongst which are the Scots. Their 4-0 defeat in Norway has left them needing all 6 points from their remaining matches against Macedonia and the Netherlands to even stand a chance of making the playoffs. Scotland currently lie third, tied with Macedonia. Is that right? Have you got a league table there?
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. What's going to go wrong this time?
What else can go wrong?
Well, everything's gone wrong for the Scots so far.
I mean, they're struggling because they've got no good players, aren't they?
I don't know. Haven't they just been really unlucky?
Yeah, but I mean, you make your own luck in this game, don't you, James?
Oh, that's true, yeah.
But, there seems to be quite a defeatist attitude at the moment around Scotland, but I don't think they're entirely out of it. They're currently in the playoff system, which obviously they're aiming for second place, as they're in the group with the Netherlands. And because there's 9 groups, only the 8 best second place teams go into the playoffs for the final 4 spots, if that makes sense. And Macedonia, who are currently second in the Group 9 table ahead of Scotland, are bottom of that list of 9 second-place teams in terms of points.
Right. But their level, as it stands, the second-place team from that group wouldn't be going into the playoff mix.
Absolutely, yeah. But on the bright side, there are 4 other teams level on points with them, although they have games in hand. I mean, it's not entirely beyond the realms of possibility that Scotland pick up 4 points that can...
It's 11...
But it is surely beyond the realms of possibility that Scotland could pick up 4 points.
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah, all right then. Elsewhere among the other British Isles teams, Wales in Group 4 lie 4th in that group with Russia and Germany. They're 6 points behind Russia, who have a game in hand, 10 points behind Germany. Northern Ireland, meanwhile, in Group 3 are 2nd. They're doing very well. They might well be in the playoff picture. They're 2 behind Slovakia, the group leaders. They've played 1 game more than Slovakia. They're 2 points ahead of Slovenia.
In that group, I dare say the Czech Republic could yet make a late charge. Their last 3 games are all at home and all very winnable.
Because
quite a tight group, if you look at it.
Right, you've got Poland in 4th place and the Czechs lying 5th in the group. 5 points behind 2nd place Northern Ireland.
Yeah, well, that's my tip for the Czechs to make a late charge.
All right, interesting stuff, Paul. What about Ireland?
Ireland are 2nd in the group.
Yes.
And they're behind Italy, 14 points.
Coming off a 3-0 defeat to Australia, Barry.
Yeah, but that was just a friendly in Limerick.
Right. All right, what about their game with Cyprus?
It's a lot of talk about, they're off to Cyprus, and it's sort of 3 years almost to the day since Sean Ingle got married, and his his wedding reception, which I attended, clashed with Cyprus 5, Ireland 2.
Right.
Now, I heard Marco Tardelli from the Tardellis down there in Tipperary, who was the assistant manager of the Irish team. He was saying that that was a freak result, you know, and there's no way Ireland should have lost that game 5-2. I beg to differ with Mr. Tardelli. He does have a World Cup winner's medal, which I don't. So, you know, his view, I would normally bow to his superior knowledge. But Ireland did thoroughly deserve to lose that game 5-2. They were awful. But this is 3 years on, it's nearly a completely different team. And
better? Is it a better Ireland team?
I think it is, yeah. Well, it couldn't be a worse Ireland team than the one that got trounced by Cyprus. Cyprus have just come off the back of a 6-1 hiding at the hands of Albania, so things aren't exactly going swimmingly for them either. And
that might have been a freak result as well.
It could have been, but you know, a draw would probably do Ireland anyway, but I would expect them to win.
Well, the situation in the group, Ireland currently in second place, just a point behind Italy, who have a game in hand though, and of course Italy still have to visit Ireland at the end of the qualifying schedule.
We're still 5 points clear of Bulgaria.
And right.
They're pretty abject.
Although they have a game in hand. Bulgaria are hosting Montenegro this weekend. They'll be confident of getting some points there, no doubt. Although Montenegro, a handy little side. I was going to ask you, Stephen Reid. No, Andy Reid, sorry. Andy Reid.
Yes.
Yes. Is he getting a look in Trapp's picture these days?
No.
Oh, okay. And Stephen Ireland, clearly not.
Stephen Ireland does not want to play for Ireland.
Yes.
And it's sort of having the same divisive thing in the country as Keane did when he was sent home / walked out of the training camp in Saipan. Ireland just won't play Stephen Ireland. So it's handy for people who have to write reports about the games and distinguishing between Ireland the player and Ireland the country.
Right.
But we could obviously do with him. He's a great player, but he has his reasons for not playing. Nobody's quite sure what they are. We can only respect them.
Suspicion was that they might have involved him being teased for his baldness.
Yes.
In the locker room.
Well, not so much his baldness as his hirsuteness.
All right.
And
okay.
Yeah, there were rumours that some of the other players had held him down and pulled his hairpiece / weave off. I don't know if that's true or not. The players in question have denied it.
Hmm. All right. Okay.
But it's all by the by. He won't play. And I mean, it's a thing that keeps coming up over and over again at Ireland press conferences: is Stephen Ireland going to play? And
right.
No.
Well, it was in the Post as well. Menduksai was curious to know your opinion, and thank you for furnishing it. Italy, you're quite confident that Ireland are going to go into that final game against Italy in an advantageous position. They this weekend are in Georgia, away to Georgia, and given the way they've been playing of late, the Italians, they could well come away miss out on the 3 points from that, which would certainly help Ireland's cause. Italy haven't scored a goal now for 270 minutes. They had an absolutely woeful time at the Confederations Cup, as you no doubt saw.
Yeah.
And it doesn't look like Lippi has responded with any great revolutions, despite the many people calling for that. It's still the old senators, as they're called, the likes of Cannavaro, etc., who are making up Italy squad.
Who will, given their goal drought, who will be their players up front? Is he persisting with Tony and Gerardino? Will Jacinta get a look
in? The suspicion is that Giuseppe Rossi, who looked the best thing about Italy in South Africa in the Confederations Cup over the summer, will be up front alongside Vincenzo Jacinta, who I suppose you could say gets the job done in an unpretentious manner. There is still this debate about whether Amaury, Brazilian from Juventus, will be able to get his Italian papers through in time to make a trip to South Africa. The suspicion is that he will. There's no sign of him calling up Pazzini and Cassano, the brilliant strike partnership which has put Sampdoria top of the Serie A table.
So is Pazzini being shunned because of his incredibly harsh red card against Ireland?
Probably that's the thing that's causing him to be shunned. He has got, I think, also the fact he doesn't play for Juventus, because Lippi, a former Juventus man, is calling up everyone from Juventus. I think there's eight and a half, if you include Crisido, who's at Genoa on loan, Juve players in the squad, and probably seven or eight of them will make the first team. Elsewhere in the wide world, etc., 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 Denmark lead Group 1, ahead of Hungary, with Portugal third and Sweden fourth. Now, Portugal are 4 points off second place in a potential playoff. But Paul, you know the reasons for their abject collapse in the qualifiers.
Well, I'm not sure how much of a collapse it is. Maybe we shouldn't be that surprised about it, because if you look back in the qualifiers for Euro 2008, they scraped through in second place behind Poland, but there didn't be any of the other good teams in that group. And by good teams, I'm including Finland, Serbia, and Poland. So they haven't actually beaten anyone good for a long time, despite obviously the wealth of talent at their disposal. That wealth of talent doesn't include a striker. They failed to replace Pauleta, who a lot of people didn't think was top class anyway, but he did get a lot of goals for them.
When was the last time that Portugal had a striker?
Pauleta.
No, but I mean a proper international goal getter.
Yeah, Eusebio. I don't know.
Seriously, what is it genetically about the Portuguese? That
well, apparently the academy at Sporting, which has produced Ronaldo, Simão, Luis Figo, players like that. All the players, all the youngsters that go there now want to emulate those greats from the past, who were all wingers. So all the talented youngsters want to be tricky wingers rather than just predators and goal getters. So they've come up with a solution for this weekend.
Does it involve Brazilian players?
Would you believe it does? A guy called Liedson, who's been playing in Portugal for 6 years, was due to get a Portuguese passport next month, but they fast-tracked the process just in time for this weekend. And last week, he got his passport. He's expected to go straight into the starting lineup for the match against Denmark. And hopefully we'll get the goals, because they lost to Sweden earlier in the group in Lisbon, which was quite an unlucky defeat. They missed a half full of chances and then conceded three goals in the last 7 minutes. And then they've had three successive nil-all draws. In all those matches, they completely dominated but just couldn't put the ball in the net. Mm. There's been a bit of a debate in Portugal as to whether Cristiano Ronaldo should start up front. And this was before, obviously, they came up with the Liedson solution.
Well, they got two very, very tough fixtures coming up on Saturday and Wednesday. They are in Copenhagen against group leaders Denmark, and then in Budapest against Hungary next Wednesday.
Hungary are interesting, because obviously a lot of people would like to see a renaissance of Hungarian football, and their lofty position at the moment suggests that maybe one is underway. But if you actually look at their wins, they've had four wins so far, two against Malta and two against Albania. So maybe a slightly false position.
All right, okay. I'm going to whistle on then to Group 2, where Greece and Switzerland are tied and face each other this weekend in Basel. That'll be interesting, Barry? In Group 5, Spain are all but clear. Behind them, you've got Turkey and Belgium being barged out of the way by the incredible Bosnia-Herzegovina, who won four of their six games in the section so far, and looking very good to make at least the playoffs. France in Group 7, Paul Doyle, 5 points behind Serbia, 4 points clear of the third-place team. They have a game in hand. They're facing Romania. Any chance of them stuffing it up?
Oh, yeah, there's always a chance
really?
Of France stuffing it up under Dominic. I mean, with all their players, especially attacking players, they should be able to blow away most teams, but they can't score for some reason. Even when they win, it's only ever 1-0. I can't remember the last time they won a competitive match by more than a goal. The mood around the team is hilariously bad. Even the headline in L'Équipe this morning, is it possible to support this team?
Really?
Yeah, and L'Équipe were trying to remember the last match France played of which they weren't booed by their own fans. And it was 2 years ago, I think, they decided. So in that atmosphere, it's pretty hard for some of the players like Gourcuff and Benzema, who's been a big disappointment for the national team. He's only flickered, really, and not shown the talent that we all know he has. I may not even start at the weekend. You may go André Pierre Gignac up front.
Now, Group 6, England look very comfortable indeed. 7 points clear of Croatia with three games to play. Croatia can conceal it all next week. But before that, there's a chance to injure all the best players in a friendly with Slovenia this weekend. Well, we'll talk about that. And bizarrely, we'll segue on to the transfer window right after this.
Football Weekly Extra on guardian.co.uk.
Now, England looking good in Group 6. They're playing Slovenia. There's probably some sort of squad news that we should be discussing at this point.
Well, David James isn't in the squad.
Right. Not in at all. But there's an injury issue there, no? Or is it just his time has...
No, he's injured. He's been nursing an injury all season. I was looking at the stats, actually. I mean, that's the one sort of vaguely interesting thing we're were trying to sort of pull out of this friendly is the goalkeeping situation.
But right.
In Capello's 16 games in charge, he's played David James in goal in every single one of the games that have mattered when he's been fit. And so I think he'll be the... Unless, of course, with the transfer window, I suppose we'll come on to later whether James will be first choice.
Let's come on to it right now, because certainly a lot of people posting in to guardian.co.uk/football and then clicking on the Football Weekly link with all sorts of transfer window-related questions. Let's see, Jack Songs. Let's talk about Alessandro Diamante this week. Who the hell is this bloke? Why does he have such swagger? Can you also talk about whatever happened to Heitinger, Dunn's golden handshake demands, Klasnic's Croatian-German background, and speculate on which Pompey player will be the last to remember the name of everyone new in the squad? There's been a lot of changes at Portsmouth.
Can I answer the Diamante one?
Yeah,
because I put that very question to Gianfranco Zola, and I can tell you what he said.
What did he say?
Because I don't know anything about it.
Right.
But he said he's a classic number 10.
Yes.
Who has all the talent to be a world superstar.
Right.
He is as a number 10, he is a playmaker, brilliant with both feet, and a set piece specialist.
Now,
I know some things about him too. Right. He's covered in tattoos, and he is also a Jesus freak.
Now, it's interesting because I've also heard him described as the new Di Canio in the sense that he's good with his feet but not quite so sharp with his head, if you get my...
It sounded like the new Zola by Zola's description.
Yeah. The curious thing about him is he's, 26 and he's kind of come onto the scene in the last year or so. His goals and brilliant midfield play were what brought Livorno up to Serie A last season. And it was seen as a bit of a surprise that nobody picked him up when he was going for a reasonably cheap price. What was it, £5.5 million, West Ham?
Does this mean, James, that in signing Diamante, Zola has unearthed a jewel?
Or a Diamante in the rough or something like that. I would think so, yeah. I think very much so, yeah. The curious story about him, equally, is that apparently he only got into, you know, proper football because he... he became pally with Fabio Galante, who's probably the playboy par excellence and nightclub, a regular of the Italian scene, nonpareil, etc. And he became friendly with Fabio Galante in the various nightclubs of the Tuscan Riviera. And Galante said, well, pop on down to Livorno, where I play, and we'll give you a trial. And that's how he made his leap into...
Well, what was it? Was it his prowess on the dance floor that led him to think he might be a good footballer?
Pals, and that's how it happens. So there you go. There's a tip for you. Anyway, well, there you go. It was the end of the transfer window on Tuesday. Winners, losers, winners. Well, let's start with losers at Portsmouth. What happened there? The massive clear out continued.
Yes, they lost Nico Kranjčar, as was expected. Held on to David James, which wasn't expected. I think Stoke had a last-ditch effort to sign him.
Stoke are building nicely there. They've Tunshai and Huth are good signings. They got some Uruguayan guy who I believe is a bit of a midfield schemer, which is something they lack at the moment.
Mm.
They're progressing well.
Very nicely. Who else came out ahead from the last couple
I think
of days?
Sunderland came out ahead. They got Michael Turner in from Hull City and lost
How good is Michael Turner? Is 12 million a reasonable price from him? I know he heads the ball clear a lot, which suggests he's got good positioning. But other than that, he's done nothing.
He's big and strong. He's been Hull's Player of the Year for the last two seasons in a row, which would suggest, given their slump, the second half of last season would suggest he must be pretty good. I haven't seen him play that much, to be honest. He's a brother of Andy Turner, is it, that plays for Tottenham?
Vinegar Hasselink has just signed for Hull, who've obviously lost Michael Turner. How did that happen? He was out of contract from Celtic, was he?
I presume so, yeah.
Yeah, he was released by Celtic at the end of the season.
Is he going to be Premier League quality?
Well, Hull, Celtic, there isn't that much between them. So if he wasn't good enough for Celtic, he may not be good enough for Hull.
Now, Aston Villa have done well, have they not? Did the Richard Dunn move went through in the end, did it?
Yeah, it was a done deal.
Hey!
We've not had that joke for every podcast I've listened to in the last 2 weeks.
Have you been listening to lots of football?
Various football podcasts.
Really?
Yeah.
John, okay. M. Meister saying that it's, well, I won't use the term he used, but he called it insane anyway. On City's part, he points out that Dunn has spent 10 years at City, regularly captain the club, won Player of the Year 4 times in a row, and has a pre-existing and outstanding understanding with Given at the back, and they're shipping him out for a mediocre centre-back who costs a lot more than they've sold Dunn for.
Yeah, well, I'd agree with that. it seems to me as bizarre a transfer as the one involving Ibrahimovic and Eto'o, which Sid kind of cleared up for us by saying Eto'o was just hard work and impossible to manage. But so I doubt that's a problem. Richard Dunne, it used to be, but he's very much tidied up his act since being caught coming into training drunk or suffering the after effects of a night out. But yeah, I think it's extraordinary. But maybe just managers get players in and new ones in, old ones out, just to mix things up a bit.
Hmm. Everton, they did well out the transfer window, didn't they, Barry?
Yes, they did.
Johnny Huitinger's
in.
Yeah. Sylvain Distin
in. Yeah. So now my bet's not looking good, is it?
Not looking good. But you know, there's a long way to go. You never know. Templeton the Rat says, for this Villa fan, it was a wonderful transfer window. First, because the big four haven't strengthened any further. And secondly, because everybody below them has strengthened. Everton, Spurs, City and Villa. Meaning that it should be, you know, a much more even contest this time around. What about Spurs? Do we put them among the winners or the losers here?
Let's have a think. So who they brought in? Was it Cranshaw? Cranshaw was the only
one? They were in for loads of other players. But
they're a Modric down, and I don't think Cranshaw is as good as Modric.
For 6 weeks or so,
He's still good.
Spurs failed to sign David Bentley once again.
They failed to get rid of him.
Sell, yes. Why is that? Why does nobody want to go near David Bentley?
What is it about the... his attitude seems to be all wrong. I mean, there's no doubt there's
He scored one of the goals of the season last year, and he used to be a real star for Blackburn.
There seems to be some... I don't know the guy, but there seems to be several question marks over his application.
Right.
And he's more interested in scouting bands for this bar nightclub he's bought in Marbella than getting his head down and training hard.
Ooh.
And the fact that he was caught drink driving just before the transfer window closed isn't going to sort of endear him to many managers. They're just going to think he's a bad egg. So I reckon once a player gets a reputation for maybe not being as hardworking as he should be, that it's going to be very difficult for him to get a good move.
You mentioned drink driving. Corentin posting in following our Mutu discussion on Monday says, if there are clauses regarding private recreational drug use in footballers' contracts, please can we have clauses regarding drink driving too? It's mind-boggling that Mutu is being chased for some €17 million while David Bentley was given the maximum club fine of 2 weeks' wages. Interesting point.
Well, Mutu isn't going to kill anyone by snorting cocaine, is he? There's a very good chance someone drink driving will kill somebody. So.
Well, indirectly, of course, by snorting cocaine, you are financing a massive criminal industry, which you know, does it, a byproduct.
Maybe he grew his own cocaine.
That is also possible. Hadn't considered that one. Yeah. Thanks, Barry. Outside the box as usual. Just on the subject of Mutu, plenty of people posting in. Blue Legend has a friend who was a former lawyer who says that actually Chelsea are well within their rights to do this. Jiminy Crickets, though, suggests we all show our support for Mutu at a handy Facebook group, which basically wants to get 14,700,000 people to each donate a pound, which is fair enough. Shane Warne's Flipper. As a Chelsea fan, I'm ashamed that while we can offer John Terry this massive new contract, that as a Chelsea fan, I feel he does not even come close to deserving. How much is it? 120,000 a week?
It was more.
170,000.
170,000 a week. We can while we're doing that, we can hound Mutu for this money. Do we really need this money? I'm really angry about it, says Shane Warne's Flipper, and indeed he is. There you go. Well, okay. Let's look at one or two other posts, actually, then, since we're here. Plenty of them, almost 400 this
week. But again, most of them were mine.
And the others were mainly about Rooney's penalty stroke
diving. Yeah, they were really boring.
That was quite dull, guys.
A lot of podophiles. A lot of podophiles out there, it seems.
Yeah, there are. There are indeed. And well done, on a related note, says Glarpots to Barry Glenning for raising the issue of the abuse constantly thrown at Arsene Wenger. Should be dealt with by the FA and Manchester United.
Well, Marina Hyde wrote about the subject today and underneath her very good blog, which I don't entirely agree with, but it was still a very well-written piece. Some clown accused me of belittling the issue on Monday's pod, possibly because I said they're just songs. But, you know, I did condemn it. I don't think it's right that people sing those songs, but at the end of the day, that's all they are, songs.
Right. Random Sausage, great name. Footballing Zelligs, he wants to talk about, i.e. pretty mediocre players who always seem to pop up in important moments in footy history. To me, says Random Sausage, the Zellig of our time is Darren Fletcher. Who else can beat the Fletch for trying to co-opt the glory? David Beckham was always a good one for that, leaping on at the back of goals.
Rio Ferdinand is the king of doing that.
Is he?
Anytime someone scores for United, Ferdinand will come in, there's a huddle of players, he'll lever himself up, he'll find out where the camera is, lever himself up and so that he's sort of most prominent in the group,
right,
and bawling into the camera.
Footballing Zelig's pulled off?
None spring right to mind.
Is it, does it have to specifically be glory grabbers? Like Christian Karambu, is he's won everything in the game without ever doing much.
Right. Okay, Chuck Schick mentions Jermaine Pennant in that context, someone who's just along for the ride and happens to be in the right team at the right time.
I think David May is the most famous one, isn't he? He was most prominent in when United won the Champions League final in 1999. And without having kicked a ball in the whole tournament, he sort of single-handedly took all the credit for their success. I don't know where he is now. I think he's retired through injury, but that was his finest hour.
Yeah. Crazy Tim, I know it's only the Blue Square Premier, but could you give one of your shout-outs to Oxford United? Played 7-1-5, drawn 2. Hey, John Ashton, can you?
I can, yeah. But yeah. Annoyingly, before we recorded the podcast, I was told that I was going to be giving a shout-out to Cambridge United, the other Oxbridge one. So I've done reams of research
on
Cambridge, including the interesting story of their moose mascot.
Oh, what's the story of Cambridge's moose mascot?
Well, can I read? It's from their official website. It's quite a funny little thing. Marvin the Moose, apparently, is their official club mascot. It all began when Hughes fan Dave Collett flew back from the UK from a holiday in Spain. Not wishing to miss the first game, he jumped straight into a car and drove up to the game without even stopping for a shower. On arrival in the away terrace, he warned fellow fans, "Don't stand near me, I smell like a moose." The travelling fans spent the remainder of what was a dull 0-0 draw perfecting their moose impression by raising collective hands to the side of their head and imitating antlers. For some reason, this caught on very quickly, and within weeks, the entire New Parkett Road end of the Abbey Stadium ground could be seen moosing visiting goalkeepers. Admittedly, other animals were experimented with in the early days, but once established, the moose could not be usurped.
And that is why we never discuss teams from outside the top four.
There you go. That's Cambridge and their moose mascot.
Absolutely, yeah.
Fantastic. And Oxford, they had a big game against Luton, didn't they? Did they win?
I don't know.
Tuesday night. Oh, well, that's
3-0.
Luton beat Crawley 3-0 on Tuesday night.
Oh, then it
please don't
Oxford.
Ask me how I know that. But
how do you know that, Barry?
I just know it.
All right, okay. John, that's fantastic. Have you got anything even remotely as exciting from the other, League One, League Two?
Well, what I would point out is that although it was a fairly dull sort of deadline day weekend in the Premier League, it was quite an interesting one. I think certainly in the Championship, where Ipswich have made a few signings, bringing in Carlos Edwards, Grant Leadbitter, and Liam Rosinia, bringing a bit of dynamism to Roy Keane's side. Evander Snow, once of Ajax and Celtic, moving to Bristol City on loan.
Ooh.
Interesting, Baz. Sorry,
I see Roy Keane is sort of buying in people he bought into Sunderland and now bringing them to Ipswich. Do you think that's a wise move?
I wonder if he's sort of doing a wannabe sort of Redknapp type thing where you just sort of go back to your old team and buy all your old players. And I don't know. I wonder if there's maybe the posters would be able to tell me if there's a club that has worked where a manager has gone back to an old team, brought a load of his old players in, and they've gone to repeat that success. I don't know if that, perhaps Van Gaal at Barcelona, would that be? Was that? All his
you can stare
players.
At me all you want.
I don't really know. I'm on very very thin ground here.
Any surprises in the season so far in Leagues 1 and 2?
Any surprises? Well, Dagenham leading League 2, having sort of hemorrhaged players over the summer.
Yeah.
Had a fantastic start. And Barnet as well, who have been a crisis club for as long as I can remember, really, have had a fantastic fantastic start as well.
Oh, that's good.
Barnet beat Notts County at the weekend. Sven's mega rich Notts County. Did they buy anyone interesting?
Did Saul Campbell play?
I don't think he's fit for a few weeks yet.
All right.
Okay. Match fit.
Yeah, interesting. There you go. That's it for part two, though, because standing by, we have Fernando Duarte to tell us all about the absolute humdinger going on in the Southern Hemisphere this weekend. I refer, of course, to Argentina-Brazil.
Hello.
Fernando Duarte.
Jimbo. How are you, my man?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm fine. Long time no speak, long time no see, my friend.
I know. Excited?
Yes, I'm excited, about Saturday. Of course I am. Also excited to talk to you guys. It's been a long, long time.
And for us...
Everybody alive there,
Okay.
Who's around today?
Oh, who's here in the pod? We have Paul Doyle.
Hi, Fernando.
Barry Glendening.
Hello, Wally. You all right?
Yeah, and you?
Yeah, I'm fine, man. I'm fine. Great news. I'm going to be a dad in March, man.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, yeah. I'm thinking of naming him Zico Romario Ronaldo, but the wife is not very keen on football names, apparently. But
she wants Falcao from me, yeah?
Couldn't you just call him Barry?
It would be difficult for people to talk. You just say Falcao here. Hello, right. Barry. You okay?
Yeah, not bad.
Right. And John Ashton.
Hey, Fernando.
Hello, John. I don't think we met before, but great to see you again.
Right. Yeah, we have met a few times.
All right,
Jesus,
okay.
I'm sorry about that. I'm a horrible person.
I was clearly not very memorable.
Oh, no, it's not that. I'm the one who usually is like with the mind all over the place. Sorry about that.
Right. Okay. Well, you've got a lot to think about at the moment, Fernando, because, of course, Argentina lie fourth in the South American qualifiers after a hideous series of defeats for them. They're only 2 points off having to go through a playoff with one of the Central American teams. And next up, they face Brazil. Fernando.
Can I also add something?
Yes.
It seems that the repechage team in the CONCACAF might be Mexico, so they don't want to be in that position to actually face Mexico in a playoff.
That would be huge, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Okay. Well, what they're looking to do is get 3 points in this game. Where is it? Rosario in Argentina.
Yeah. It's the same place where Brazil and Argentina played an amazing match in the 1978 World Cup, which has been nicknamed the Battle of Rosario. I mean, there was a draw, a very, very tough match. And then Brazil was really in the driving seat to go to the final. But then we all remember Peru, basically opening the floodgate for Argentina to score 6 goals. I don't want to go into the motives, but it still sounds very dodgy these days.
Yeah, the goalkeeper was born in Argentina, isn't that right?
Yeah, good old Quiroga.
My word. Now, this time, Brazil come in having just won the Confederations Cup. You're back in the top of the world rankings. You won 10 and drawn 1 of your last 11 matches, whereas Argentina, as I mentioned, are coming off that 6-1 defeat at Bolivia and then 2-0 in Ecuador. Any team surprises in the Brazil lineup you're anticipating?
So far, no. I think that he's going to come with the same bunch of guys who've been playing regularly. I mean, it's a very important game for Brazil as well. I know we still have 3 rounds. We just need 3 points in 3 matches or 4 matches. I don't remember exactly the amount now. Hmm. Winning against Argentina would be massive. Would put us in the World Cup. And for the local rivalries, we would put them in trouble, which is always interesting.
Fernando, Dunga being the man he is, do you think he'll go into that game looking for a draw?
Well, he's got a point to prove in terms of people saying that when it comes to the big games, he seems to be too cautious. I mean, even though he's beaten Argentina, he's beaten Italy as well. I think he's going to try to win this match. It's also important. Brazil haven't won in Argentina since 1995. Mm. So there's this kind of taboo to this kind of duck to be broken. Obviously, he doesn't need to win this game in terms of points, but the pressure will be on him as well. If we don't perform well, people are going to start saying, so when push comes to shove, we're still not actually going that step further. Besides, there's a game against Chile, there were a couple of days after, which is not easy as well. Chile are doing well. So I think he's going to try to win this game. He should try, at least.
Mm. Who will he be picking up front, do you think?
That's Luis Fabiano. That's a no-brainer. Luis Fabiano and Robinho. Luis Fabiano has been like amazing. His goal average is almost as good as Romario in the national team. The guy's been really, really in a fantastic phase in his career. I think he scored 17 goals in 20 matches for Brazil, which has been really, really, really fundamental for us. In my opinion, he's the best Brazilian striker at the moment.
Right.
Never mind what people have been saying about Ronaldo once going back to the national team. Luis Fabiano is, for me, compulsory with the number 9 shirt, and I hope he's going to be able to finally score against Argentina, something he's never done before.
If any match was worth staying up for, it's Argentina-Brazil. We're outside.
Yeah, the players are actually really looking forward to that. And I was talking to Daniel Alves in Estonia, where Brazil played a friendly a couple of weeks ago.
Right.
And he was saying, listen, I love Messi, he's my brother, but I want to see him crying after that match. You know, the players are kind of sensing this, putting Argentina into trouble. You know, this rivalry is really healthy. We never threw bombs at each other like some countries in Europe, etc. It's much more something really related to continental issues and footballing issues. So I just hope that people will be able to kind of like take this into a peaceful way, just into the normal banter of sports.
Right. Do you think there's any danger of it becoming a rough match?
Oh yeah, totally. I remember a friendly in 93, where there were like 5 red cards, and it was a friendly match. So yeah. I wouldn't be surprised. Brazilians are very, very These players are very nervous sometimes. Against Estonia, there were 6 yellow cards, and I saw Kaká, for example, kicking the heels of another player. If it gets too physical, we might see some ugly scenes. I just hope it doesn't come to that.
My word, eh? Well, plenty to look forward to there then, Saturday night in Rosario. And Fernando, congratulations from all of us here, and we look forward to speaking to you again soon.
No problem, man. Always a pleasure for me.
Thank you very much, Fernando. Africa, Paul Doyle. Is this weekend going to be decisive in terms of anyone's chances?
Ivory Coast could seal qualification.
Ghana
could seal qualification.
Ooh, Barry Glynn, didn't he?
Nigeria have a must-win match, really, against at home to Tunisia.
Barry's muscling in on your African tour.
In the same part of my brain that I stored the Luton 3 Crawley 0 result, I also am aware that Burkina Faso are in with a shout.
They are, yeah. They're one of the upcoming teams on the continent. They have to beat Ivory Coast in Ivory Coast this weekend to have any chance of going through. So that's unlikely. But they're a team to watch for the future.
Are there any star players we should know about from Burkina Faso?
Just loads of young guys.
All right, nice one. Crazy. Let's see. Oh, the other news this week, and I think this could probably wrap up today's Football Weekly Extra, is the sudden resignation in Rome at the start of this week of Luciano Spalletti and the arrival in his place of Claudio Ranieri. My word. And all sorts of interesting things here. Spalletti, obviously Roma just got beaten 3-1 at home by Juve last weekend, putting them at the bottom of the table. They're only 2 weeks into the season. But that and the fact that the club had sold Aquilani, didn't spend the money on anything. There's also talk that he and Totti didn't see terribly eye to eye. And if you don't see eye to eye with Totti, then Roma's really no place for you, probably as a city as much as a club. However, Totti had some very, very complimentary words to him. But anyway, Spalletti decided that was it. It was time to walk. And you know, give the fellow credit, he also renounced 2 years' worth of salary. You know, usually Italian clubs, when a manager leaves, they actually stay paying them for the duration of their contract.
You don't have to go to Italy for that.
Well, yeah, indeed. But no, here they would pay them off. They don't tend to leave their contracts running.
But he resigned, didn't he?
He did resign. They basically terminated the contract, and he said, "Listen, anyone who was involved with Roma, any manager in my position, seeing the club and state they're in, would do the same thing. So I don't even want to talk about it too much," he said. But anyway, so he turned that down. There was some talk that he might go to Zenit. If I were Leonardo at Milan, I might get a little bit worried about the fact that Luciano Spalletti is now twiddling his thumbs, because Spalletti had been mentioned as recently as earlier this year as a potential Milan manager, possibly in a swap deal with Ancelotti before Ancelotti joined Chelsea. So Leonardo is off to a rotten start with the Rossoneri. Grazia Roma says he, for example, is worried that Roma's commitment to beautiful football might be undermined by the arrival of Claudio Ranieri, who certainly was talking about pragmatism in his introductory press conference.
James, if Roma's finances are in such a bad shape, would there ever be a situation where Totti might be forced to leave the club?
Well, I think those days are gone now, huh?
I mean, would nobody be interested in him?
Well, what age is he now? 32?
Still a couple of years left.
Yeah, that's true, but no, I mean, I think no.
Bolton,
yeah.
Blackburn, sorry. Indeed. That's for Sam Allardyce, isn't it?
I think that, you know, there are players that they would sell off, but selling Totti would you know, as unpopular as Rossell Asensi, the club president, is now, selling Totti would make her life quite literally unlivable, I suspect. It wouldn't be seen as a laughing matter. Ranieri, though, he could do a good job there. You know, they certainly did need a shake-up, and especially at the back where they've been absolutely rotten. And lots of people posting in saying that Ranieri's had bad press. Mowgli84 pointing out that he basically set Chelsea up for Mourinho to win the title, and that he's generally been a good talent spotter. And he also, it bears pointing out, got Juve up to third last season on their return to the top flight. So not bad.
And he once gave you a bag of biscuits.
Two bags of really, really special biscuits.
And I think that's the real reason you're quite fond of him. Well, nothing to do with these.
Claudio Ranieri is a lovely chap.
Oh, I'm sure he is.
No, I mean, there's no. There's only one person who I've met who doesn't like Claudio Ranieri. And bizarrely, that is the other person who's famous as being the loveliest man in football. Perhaps it's a sort of rivalry.
Dave Grohl?
No, in football.
Oh, sorry.
Ray Wilkins. When he came in at Chelsea, that's right, Ray was already there. Yeah.
And did Ray have to move sideways?
After a small period of handing on, was then I think he felt that it was a bit brusque, not only for him but for other people involved in the coaching setup.
Has Ray Wilkins ever given you biscuits?
No, actually, he hasn't.
If he did, what kind of biscuit do you think he'd give you?
I think a hearty digestive. Mm. There you go, fella, he would say. By the way, these digestives are all right. I can't do raise eggs.
I'm quite intrigued by these special biscuits. Were they special biscuits in inverted commas? Do you feel all nice and mellow after?
All right, let's not get into managers with bags of special biscuits. Right? Crikey, is that it for today's podcast? Yes, of course it is. And many, many thanks then to Paul Doyle and Barry Glendenning and John Ashdown, to Fernando Duache, everybody who posted in this week, especially those who weren't talking about Rooney's dive or penalty issue. Many, many thanks to the good folks there on the knobs, Pete and Ben. We'll be back on Monday with an update on the international situation. And let me just remind you one more time, September the 20th at about 6 o'clock in the afternoon, we'll be live. So, see you soon, Pod fans.
Football Weekly Extra from The Guardian in association with SportingBet.com.